A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It is the dawning of the age of Boris Johnson. On this week's New Statesman podcast, Anoush and I discuss whether or not the former mayor of London can be stopped as his lead among MPs grows and grows. And you ask us, are those Tory MPs buying a false bill of goods? And in the other leadership election, we discuss who will emerge as Vince Cable's successor. As we speak, all 10 of the candidates have now officially launched their bids, and from the perspective of most people listening to it, the first ballot will not yet have happened. But of course, for those of you who listen to this on your way home on Thursdays, and those of you who listen to it throughout the week, the first ballot will of course have been and gone. However, in many ways, actually, although I obviously love voting, actually the leadership election from an interest perspective looks pretty fixed. So I'm joined by Anoush to discuss the state of the Tories, the state of their race, which does feel like it's essentially over unless Boris Johnson does something catastrophic to destroy his leadership, but I can't actually really work out what that would be.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Westminster wisdom, or what people always like to say, is the Tory leadership front runner never wins. And I've been thinking about that a lot in terms of this contest, and I really can't think of the scenario where that actually happens this time and Boris Johnson trips up and someone else gets the leadership. So, but of course, the problem with saying that is, of course, like there's always unknowns.
Yeah.
So we can't predict what will happen. And also it is quite a long time, 6 weeks. So there could be other things that happen in the meantime that somehow trip him up.
Yeah. I mean, so I guess the reason why I sort of find it hard to see how it can happen is, one, it feels like this is already a candidate, right, who is somehow managing to run as being the one you need to vote for to win an election, while at the same time his campaign team are talking about the fact that they've like very carefully restricted media access. It's like he is the candidate who's so damn electable that if he would have to answer as many as 7 questions from a journalist in a day, his leadership campaign could be overturned. And yet Tory MPs are able to hold these obviously contradictory ideas.
You've hit the nail on the head. I did a piece this week, which listeners can read if they would like, about the Tory members and who they want to vote for in the final two, if they are given a choice of the final two. And that is exactly the contradiction. So they would say, oh, you know, I'm not a big fan and he's very flawed, but I think it's going to have to be Boris Johnson because he's got that broader appeal to the electorate. And then in the next breath, they say, the worst thing for our party would be a general election. You know, it's an existential crisis. We'd be wiped out. So how can you think those two things? How can you think I'm going to elect someone who I think the general public would vote for in an election, but the worst thing I can possibly imagine is a general election? Those two things don't make sense put together. So I do think that in a way, both Tory MPs who have been endorsing him and the Tory members who are going to hold their noses and vote for him, because there are quite a few, despite assumptions, they've got it wrong. And the majority of, I mean, according to the most recent YouGov polling, the majority of the country feel negatively towards Boris Johnson. I know that can change when he's up against, you know, whoever he's up against, which will be Jeremy Corbyn.
I think the thing is, I'm kind of dubious that it can change, right? I mean, it could, right? So one of the interesting things is we don't fully know why it is that opinion about the two candidates in 2017 was so volatile.
Mm.
However, one reason that feels to me fairly likely is most people did not really know very much about Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn. They knew that Theresa May was, they thought she was dull, and I do think there's a very ingrained thing in our culture that people in Britain tend to assume that dullness is a sign of competence. They knew that Labour had elected a leader who was not like other Labour leaders, and he was quite unpopular, but he was not firmly so, right? People couldn't really articulate why. And all of the polls showed that people didn't really hold very strong opinions about either of them and didn't know very much about May or Corbyn. And I think that was a huge contributor to the ability of Labour's very effective campaign to change minds.
Yeah.
Like, the thing is quite interesting is watching Boris Johnson now feels a lot like watching a really aged footballer, right? There's the same kind of political skill, like the understanding of the, like, oh, I get where public opinion is here, right? So that way that he isn't, unlike a lot of leavers, doing a very short-sighted, I know, I'll embrace this deeply toxic American and president and equate support for Trump, an opinion which, you know, barely a plurality of UKIP voters hold, with support for Brexit, which got 17 million, right? He understands all of that stuff, and he can still kind of do that stuff quite well.
Mm.
But, of course, he's deeply polarising. A lot of people don't find the routine funny anymore. And almost everyone in the country has a strong opinion about him. So I think, like, the capacity of those skills to turn around how people feel about him, I feel, feels quite limited. Of course, elections are comparative, and I also think that this idea that a lot of people in the Labour Party have, that, oh, come an election, there'll be a similar transformation in Corbyn's ratings as there were last time, could be, of course, that the people around Johnson, the people around Corbyn are right, and in a campaign they can do that. However, because unlike last time, yeah, like, most people did not have strong opinions about Corbyn and May at the start of that campaign.
Mm.
They very much have strong opinions about Corbyn and May now, and they very much have strong opinions about Johnson as well. However, I guess the question I have for you, someone who's spent ages talking to these people out in Beaconsfield, is can you see a way that the other candidate in the top two could persuade members not to vote for him?
I think that it's more open than we as journalists generally tend to portray the competition. I do think that it's not impossible that someone else could win in the final two to Boris Johnson. A lot of people I spoke to from the, you know, from the real heartland, very, very Tory areas with larger than usual Conservative Party associations, which are the local parties, a lot of people said, I'll see who it comes down to in the final two. I'll probably vote for the other one. But when you actually dig into that, they want someone who's a Brexiteer. So Dominic Raab came up a lot, and I know his campaign hasn't been particularly successful, as well as Michael Gove. So maybe when it comes down to the final two, those waverers will think, well, at least Boris Johnson represents Brexit more than the other one. So actually, you know, I think it's more open than we think, but I do think Boris Johnson still has the biggest chance in that final two decision. One of the key things that people were saying about Boris Johnson is that, you know, that that they've been told that he's the front runner, so they think that he's the most likely to win. And I was speaking to Professor Tim Bale, who's from the Queen Mary University of London, who's done lots of party members' research. And he was saying party members are actually no different to the general voter in the sense that they don't actually know much about a lot of the candidates. They might not have even heard of some of their names. And they take their cue from newspapers like the Daily Telegraph. The majority of Tory members read the Daily Telegraph as their newspaper, and the Mail and other such right-wing publications, which are sort of repeating this line that he is the front runner. And so the sort of more you hear it, the more you think it, the more you feel that you should back a winner. And of course, MPs are starting to feel that they should back a winner, perhaps for different reasons, but they want to be, you know, someone who is in his favour when or if he becomes Prime Minister. So I think there's a lot of sort of, there's a lot of people being influenced by just the received wisdom at the moment.
Yeah, and I think the thing that everyone seems to have forgotten is that in the 2015 Labour leadership election, Corbyn was nowhere among party members up until that first BBC hustings, because that was when most Labour members had first properly seen him.
Mm.
You know, they knew that, oh, there was this guy, oh, he's fairly radical, he's, you know, been around for a long time. But their first sort of impression of him, the moment when in the private polls that were commissioned for the leadership campaigns, and of course we wrote about on the New Statesman website, the moment that he came into the lead was not the welfare bill or any of that stuff and the other campaigns have subsequently tried to blame other people for their own failures on. It was after that first BBC debate. That is, I think, really the one way I could see him not winning would be if someone else on that BBC debate does sort of do something hugely impressive and kind of does, you know, essentially does what Cameron did in 2005 and go, look, I'm your winner. I'm the one who can get us out of this mess. obviously the mess now is of a very different complexion, but...
Definitely, yeah. I think for the other candidates, it's all about getting airtime now. And the irony is that Boris Johnson has been turning down all media requests and interviews, but he's still getting the most airtime because everyone's sort of realised that he's most likely to win. So he doesn't really need to do that much press, whereas the others really need to get themselves out there.
Yeah, I think it does feel strange to me, the number of people doing these kind of like veiled sort of like, lol, it's a serious time, we need a serious leader, or, oh, yeah, you're going to pull out. And he's just like, guys... No one is voting for him under the belief that they think he's a serious figure. Like, literally, no MP who is backing Boris has said, oh, do you know what I'm doing? I'm backing him because of, like, his, you know, his depth of thought about, you know, how to rework the British state, right?
Yeah.
They all say something like, it needs to be a Brexiteer and it needs to be someone who can win, right? That is literally
exactly,
the...
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I just find it bizarre how few of them have, even the ones who've said things which are going to make it hard for them to serve in a Boris government, still seem to think that the way to get Tory members to not vote for Boris Johnson is to go, oh, lol, he's not serious, and not to attack what I guess will be the next thing we discuss in part two, which is whether or not he actually is still all that electable.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
Indeed. And the question that people are essentially asking us is, well, look, is Boris Johnson the most electable candidate? Yeah, obviously we've had two hypothetical polls about in which he would get... Well, with YouGov, he'd get them up to 29% of the vote. With Comres, he would get them up to 36% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
Labour would be on around 22%, and the Lib Dems are around 20%. So, of course, under our electoral system, it does not matter how many votes you get, it's where you get them and where the other lot finish. So both of those would put him into majority territory, although it's hard to be exactly clear how big a majority. And if you obviously covered... Let's actually not think about how many elections we've done. It's just going to make us all sad. Feel sad and old. Yeah, you're someone who was in London during those peaks of genuine popularity.
Yeah.
Is he still the person that he was then from a electoral perspective?
I'd say something that really showed me, and this is anecdotal rather than, you know, scientific, that showed me he is no longer the Boris Johnson of those heady London mayoralty days, was when I went to the anti-Trump protest recently. Every single speaker, almost every single banner and placard, just everything that was happening at that protest, mentioned Boris Johnson in the same breath as Donald Trump. Obviously, we've spoken about it before in the podcast, not sort of tying Donald Trump too much with people who are pro-Brexit. But his name came up with Nigel Farage. His name came up with Tommy Robinson's name in one of the speeches by someone who was at the rally. And I think that means that Boris Johnson is associated with everything that people hate in London, or seats that copy the sort of electoral preferences of London. So I think he's lost that constituency now. You know, I like to always think of where I grew up, which is the seat of Ealing Central and Acton. That's a real swing seat, and Boris Johnson was very popular there when he was London mayor, as far as I could tell, and I really think that a seat like that now would never, ever show support for Boris Johnson in a million years. And that's sort of a Tory Labour marginal. So when you go to those kind of seats around the country, they're definitely not going to vote for Boris Johnson, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think... So it's odd, because I think the argument that a lot of his backers make in terms of his electability is flatly wrong, right? As you say, they went to go because he's the person who won London. It's just, I mean, that is quite literally like me saying to someone, hey, if you want a like great authentic Mexican food, go to Green and Red just off Brick Lane. I mean, it's been an estate agent for a decade now. Anyone who goes there for expecting good Mexican food is going to be looking at pictures of homes they can't buy. But the the flip side of that, of course, is if you would still be able to eat something nice on Brick Lane. You just wouldn't be able to eat the nice, authentic Mexican food that I had suggested you would be able to. And he obviously is not going to. His electoral coalition of support is radically different to what it was. Fundamentally, he might be the candidate for putting the Brexit Party back in its box, but he obviously also puts the Liberal Democrats on steroids. Now, yeah. I think, essentially, the question that kind of some of his more kind of thoughtful backers, yeah, the argument they make, which I think is a lot more persuasive, is Brexit means the Conservative Party is going to have to become a party of Brexit, right? It can't get out of doing it because there was a referendum, because of where its voters are, because of where its MPs are. Mm. That means that its electoral coalition is going to have to be even more Brexity than it is now, which means essentially you have to try. And now, obviously, there is a long-term realignment of voting intention, essentially a because of growing, so, about, the young and the old and city dwellers, which the problem, of course, is then if you end up in the kind of Theresa May trap where you don't win Kensington anymore, but you don't win Bishop Auckland.
Mm.
There is a persuasive argument to be made that Boris Johnson, if the thing that the Conservatives need to do is basically just go, OK, well, we're just going to run as hard as we can at Bishop Auckland and hope we can win that. And also hope that by the time we've won that, we haven't lost so many places like Putney, Hastings, etc., that the exercise has been rendered completely moot. Yeah, I usually don't like comparing people to US politics because the differences are so large. Mm. But the one way it is instructive, right, is Hillary Clinton is the Democrat who came closest to winning Texas in the last 20 years. She's also, of course, the first Democrat to lose Pennsylvania for the last 20 years. That electoral tactic might turn out to be, we might in 10 years' time go, of course, there's now this thing where Republicans can win every other section, but they just lose in the Electoral College because Democrats win Texas now. And Pennsylvania used to be a solid Democratic state and is now a swing marginal. It may be that we say that. However, of course, in the here and now, Donald Trump is president, and it doesn't feel that the electoral strategy of trying to win Texas and not winning Pennsylvania is likely to, obviously, is a useful model if you're any other presidential system in the world where you have to get 50% of the vote plus one.
Not particularly
useful for the Democrats. And I kind of suspect that the Tory idea that, you can just fast-track your evolution to be a party of Brexit probably doesn't quite work.
Yeah, I think it is actually at this time impossible to tell whether that would work. But I've been to a few of these seats where, people characterise them as Labour heartlands, where they're losing they're rapidly losing their core vote because people voted for Brexit and feel that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't represent that quite strongly enough. I don't see, at the moment, a Boris Johnson-led Conservative Party shifting Labour out of power in those seats or dampening their vote enough to sort of mean that strategy will win them lots of places that they've never won before. Because while people will praise Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party or UKIP or whoever that third party may be that represents the sort of no-deal hard Brexit side of things, there's not enthusiasm for Boris Johnson in those seats yet.
Yeah, I also think my instinct is always that the problem for anyone saying, we'll just become a party of Remain, we'll just become a party of Leave, is despite how hard people try and, ignore lots of information and the amount of partisan reasoning putting into it, there simply isn't an economically cogent coalition you can build only of Remain voters or only of Leave
voters.
No,
there isn't.
It's like whenever someone does one of those kind of we need a party with, Rory Stewart, Mike Gapes, Jess Phillips, Keir Starmer, Dominic Grieve in it. And it's just like, so that is three different opinions about trade union regulation, four different opinions about foreign policy. It's just one of those things where it's just like domestic policy, just because the government barely does it anymore, doesn't change the fact, and it does still move a hell of a lot of votes.
Yep.
And there is no domestic policy offer to Leave voters voting Labour that does not end up either alienating quite a lot of existing Leave voters voting Conservative. Or indeed a lot of Remain voters who are still voting Conservative. And at that point, you're just like, but you might as well try and appeal to all Labour voters instead of kind of having this kind of weird sectional thing. I think the other thing I'm dubious about, and I'm really intrigued to know what you think about this, is all of these polls suggesting that Boris Johnson would improve the Tory position are based on the idea that when push comes to shove, if Boris Johnson is Prime Minister on a harder Brexit platform, 20% of people will still vote Lib Dem, or indeed will still vote Labour. I just kind of feel like I might be completely wrong, but I just don't quite see how, in a situation in which there's a risk of a Boris Johnson premiership. A lot of those people won't vote for the party which they think has the best chance of stopping him, which obviously in some places will be the Liberal Democrats, but in a heck of a lot of places
will be Labour.
Yeah,
exactly. It comes down to those kind of Labour Tory marginals that we were discussing before. And also Boris Johnson represents a hell of a lot more than just no deal Brexit or hard Brexit to voters. There's a sort of cultural revulsion towards him because of the way that he's sort of conducted himself since the referendum campaign. So it is to do with Brexit, but it's also to do with the fact that he is sort of this sort of right-wing Tory posh bogeyman figure that people just don't want to see in government, who are against that sort of cultural shift of things. And so even if you're not the biggest fan of Jeremy Corbyn, you'd probably vote Labour in a seat where you know that it would make the difference to stop the Tories.
Yeah, because I think this thing is like, yeah, obviously, and I must admit, I still don't really understand. I can understand the following sentence. I am a Remainer and I am annoyed with Jeremy Corbyn's Brexit position.
Yeah.
I cannot understand the actual observed phenomena, which is I am a Remainer and I am annoyed by Jeremy Corbyn's Brexit programme and I wasn't annoyed in 2017. However, I accept that that is a huge number of people. The difference is because it is bluntly difficult to work out exactly what the event that finally... Maybe it was the change launch. I think that may have been part of it. Maybe it was the physical fact of us being in the EU past the 29th of March, which maybe meant a lot of people who thought that Brexit was unstoppable have kind of thought, maybe we can stop it. Maybe I will vote Green or Lib Dem. Yeah, who knows? Maybe it's a combination of those things. But because it is a phenomenon that I find hard to explain, yeah, weirdly, I feel I could understand Remain voters going, yeah, being willing to do this thing where they go, oh, maybe Labour does have a different policy to the one that is explicitly written in black and white, and yeah, people say all the time, Monty. I could understand that. I could understand being annoyed about that policy. The weird thing is, because I'm aware that I don't really fully understand, and I don't think we'll ever have enough data to fully work out what triggered this period of change, we are in this position where we're just going, well, maybe it'll change back.
Yeah.
So there is another leadership election going on,
yep,
to elect the leader of the Liberal Democrats. This is the third leadership election since 2015, but it's, of course, the first one in which, like, the central thing is not, are the Lib Dems doomed? Obviously, I've just interviewed Ed Davey in this week's magazine. Last time you interviewed Norman Lamb.
Yes, yeah.
I interviewed Tim Farron. So whether or not that means I have switched roles with you or if I will continue my hot streak, we wait to find out.
And I interviewed Vince Cable when there was no contest. Yeah. Yeah,
okay, oh, right. So actually, yeah. So I guess you have already broken your streak then.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it feels so hard to... It actually almost feels valueless to kind of... Whenever I go on TV to talk about it, people go, oh, who's going to win? It's just like, well, it's really hard to tell because you have two quite strong candidates. You have a party where, okay, the reason why they're changing their leader is because the current leader wants to stand down,
yeah,
but they're not a party with an obvious problem, which makes it hard to work out what their members will be thinking when they sit down to vote.
Yeah, and I'd like to know from you, having interviewed Ed Davey, what you think the difference will make, actually, whether it's him or Joe Swinson. Will it make a difference to the Lib Dems, considering they're going to hoover up those Remain votes in constituencies where they have the most chance of stopping the Conservatives getting in a general election?
So I think from a direct electoral perspective, I don't think it makes that much difference either way. In many ways, right, the Lib Dems, I think, are... at the next election, more of a function than a force, right? In that their political success comes from having a very strong, clear position on Brexit. And then, of course, their historical positions on other issues and are going up, you know, the list of relevance, like climate change. But that position, kind of in an odd way, right? That position is either a magnetic attraction or it's not.
Yeah.
But they are going to hold that position. That position is set by their members, not by their leader. The slightly surreal thing, I think, about covering a Lib Dem leadership election, right, is that there are loads and loads of questions about policy for people who do not set policy. but, of course, it's very difficult to work out what type of questions you can ask when actually what you are kind of choosing, and you're choosing a Lib Dem leader, is a show pony, because you kind of can't go like, well, how are you going to respond to five awkward questions? Yeah, like, pretend you're being doorstepped right now.
Yeah.
I think from an electoral perspective, I think their strengths and weaknesses in the country probably cancel each other out.
Yeah, okay.
I think the interesting question is, although obviously, you know, the Lib Dems are basically the only party where you can regularly get an applause line. Yeah, that actually the biggest applause line in Vince Cable's European Manifesto launch was when he went, "We're still open to vote working with other parties," right?
Yeah.
But I think the big question I have, right, is although they're both, you know, they both do it on various campaigns, you know, they're both open to it. Jo Swinson has, you know, worked on the People's Vote campaign. Obviously, you know, being a Scottish MP, she worked on Better Together. There are more immediate kinship ties with other MPs. Mm. Now, of course, fascinating thing about the last however many months, and we will never be able to sort of disentangle the extent to which, you know, did the independent group's launch help trigger people looking again at the Liberal Democrats? Was it just that we'd got to a certain point in politics where people were willing to do that again? We don't know. But the interesting thing is the political diagnosis that the independent group got wrong and then Change UK then was catastrophically exposed to was this idea that the Liberal Democrats could not do what they did in the locals. The other argument they had was that the Liberal Democrats were not an attractive vehicle for MPs to defect to because people have had... Yeah, had fought with them in local elections, fought with them in general elections, and that you needed another space for Tory MPs and Labour MPs who are unhappy with their leadership to go.
Mm.
And that argument is significantly less obviously debunked than the... I do find it ridiculous, the number of actual adults whose political position is that they believe that the Conservative Party is going to take us off the cliff economically and that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite and the Labour Party is institutionally anti-Semitic, but their feelings about Ed Davies' opinion on Trident,
yeah,
or like whether or not Jo Swinson smiled too much in photos with the coalition.
Yeah, with George Osborne.
It's just one of those things where it's just like, well, guys, you clearly don't actually... Which one of these three things are you lying about? Because yeah, if you sincerely believe the first two things, grow up about the last thing. And a surprisingly large number of adults are willing to self-incriminate by going, God damn it, my opinions about the future of our economic model and the condition of an ethnic minority in this country aren't quite as important as my feelings about Nick Clegg.
Yeah.
And these people are adults who will say this on the record. It blows my mind. But
I guess, there's no pure person to yeah, vote for.
Yeah. I just think the question is, right, is if the Liberal Democrats can be a place that is a destination for people who've said, I don't think Boris Johnson is a fit and proper person to lead the party, or people who are disgusted by Labour's Brexit policy, Labour's inability to tackle anti-Semitism in its ranks, I think Jo Swinson is probably better optimised to do that. However, to be blunt, I kind of think that people won't ever actually leave the Conservative or the Labour Party anyway. So I think it's a theoretical advantage. But, I mean, obviously it may be that we get out of this room and, you know, 15 people have finally left the Labour Party or 6 people have gone, oh, I guess all of those things I've said about Boris Johnson not being a fit and proper person should have some kind of meaning. But I just don't buy it.
Yeah, I remember when we were covering the previous contest, one of the big questions was, have people forgotten, or like the young people that they want to appeal to, have they forgotten the coalition and how angry they were about the tuition fees betrayal and just in general working in government with the Conservative sort of austerity regime? And I think that question still hasn't actually been answered, because obviously that's been masked by the pro-Remain vote that the Lib Dems have hoovered up in the local elections. So someone like Jo Swinson, I think, as you say, yes, she was part of the coalition, but she can point to a lot of things that she did in that government that were progressive.
Yeah.
And she also, as you say, has been part of the People's Vote campaign. And so, you know, going around universities or university towns, perhaps she'll have the slight edge on Ed Davey in terms of that particular section of the vote.
And I think also this, it does come back to the, like, where do people think, what do people think the most enduring places the Lib Dems can make gains are? Is it by being... Yeah, and I kind of think the coalition stuff is probably a bit overplayed in that, one, they were still able to make this gains with someone who was a national figure, right? Vince Cable was a national figure in the coalition in the way that, yes, Ed Davey was Secretary of State for Climate Change, but you cannot claim that either he or Jo Swinson were national figures. If it is being a party of... Yeah, in terms of the votes it's going to target next, I used to be a Tory, I want to stay in the EU, I don't like that I can see bits of the public realm falling apart, I don't like Brexit, and I'm uneasy about the present Labour Party, then you can see how Ed Davey is probably better optimised. If it is the, I don't like Labour's Brexit position, I think there's something really iffy about the way it's dealt with anti-Semitism, and of course the argument becomes, a much stronger one for Jo Swinson. But yeah, I think I do sort of think in an odd way, the success of the Liberal Democrats is so much to do with A, our electoral system, B, how people feel about Boris Johnson, C, what Brexit position Labour actually has going into the next election, then in an odd way, I kind of think neither of us, yeah, I think we can, yeah, let the, yeah, time is sufficiently passed, right? Neither of us thought that Tim Farron was the better choice for the Liberal Democrats in 2015.
This is the Norman Lamb fan club podcast now.
Yeah. And I think in terms of the way that Tim Farron's personal views on homosexuality and abortion destroyed their election campaign, shows that some of the doubts that we had about him were true. However, the thing that has clearly been the salvation of the Liberal Democrats from an electoral perspective in large chunks of the country, which was their avowed opposition to Brexit, would not have happened under anyone other than Tim Farron. So it is so difficult to work out what the conditions a party will
exist. And actually, to be fair to Tim Farron, there were lots of, well, not lots, but a few Lib Dem MPs saying, you know, this manifesto is really unhelpful, particularly those in places like the Southwest where there were votes for Brexit that they had to try and somehow still win. I remember when I interviewed Vince Cable when he was about to become leader, he was saying, oh, you know, the manifesto didn't work. People didn't understand that a second referendum meant on the deal rather than just a rerun. So I think, you know, sticking to that very unequivocal Remain path wasn't necessarily the easiest decision, but it's borne itself out.
Yeah, and I think basically any other Liberal Democrat leader would not have done so, which shows that essentially you shouldn't listen. So basically shows this is the podcast of people who are wrong about who should lead the Liberal Democrats, wrong about who should lead the Labour Party, wrong about who should lead the Conservative Party. Next week we'll be discussing the SNP. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Anoush Shekelian. It's recorded by Emily Bootle, produced by Nick Hilton. Our music is licensed under Creative Commons and is Devil by the Devil.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.